mine.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mate. It's a podcast where we will help you learn to invest in 20 minutes or less. We break down the world of investing from beginning to dividend so that you can hopefully make some returns. My name's Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going, bro?
Very good, Bryce. How are you?
Good, mate. Good. Ready to crack into something that we haven't done on this show before. It's a brand new segment. We introduced it midway through last month, and because it's the first episode of November, it is time to do book club.
we need like a jingle or something here.
We do. We'll get one of our mates to whip one up.
Yeah. Well, you did half a percussion degree. Maybe you can.
I can do half a tune.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we sort of discussed maybe three or four episodes ago, first episode of every month, we are going to do a quick review on the book that we have finished reading for the previous month. And for the month of October, I firstly hope that some of our listeners joined along and read it with us. We read Michael Lewis's book, Liar's Poker. He was the author of The Big Short, which is now a really good movie and well worth watching. And Ren, this was one of your picks, and it's all about life on Wall Street as a bond trader. And I've got to say, it was pretty entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, Michael Lewis's books generally are. He also wrote Moneyball, if people have seen the Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill movie. I'm pretty sure they star in it. Before we get into the book, I think it's probably important to reiterate why we're doing this. You know, reading is, for us, we found it so valuable, and all of the people that we interview through this podcast just say the same thing over and over again, that the reading, both books and investor letters and stuff like that, has just been of exponential value to them. And we wanted to create this book club to help our listeners come on that journey, to recommend some books, and sort of create a communal feel around it. So we're going to be reading them every month. We hope that you join us, and we hope that you benefit from them. And if you have any suggestions for books, we're definitely all ears.
All eyes.
We're all eyes, you know? Yeah. Liar's Poker.
Yes.
I thought poker, isn't that tautology? Like, poker is, part of that is lying anyway. There's no such thing as honesty poker.
Honest poker. What a boring game that would be.
Yeah.
Well, let's start when Ren addressing Liar's Poker. What is Liar's Poker?
So it's a game that these traders would play, and if any of our listeners have played Perudo with dice, it's a similar game to that. But essentially, what you do is you pull a note out, and every note has a serial code on it, a string of numbers. So you have 9 numbers on an Australian note, and everyone else has the same 9 numbers. You need to guess out of that total how many there are. You start your bid, and then everyone has to one-up you. So they either have to say there's more of that number or there's X amount of a higher number. So you've got to keep one-upping each other, and then eventually someone will call bullshit, and then you'll see how many there are.
All right, so everyone gets what it is now, hopefully, from Ren's explanation. So
I don't even think I get what it is from that explanation. But if you want to understand it and play it and become a bond trader, just Google Perudo or Liar's Poker, or read the book even. That's probably what we should recommend.
Yeah.
Join the book club and read the book.
Oh, God. So do you want to give it a crack, Ren?
Well, the more I think about it, the more I think it's just not going to translate over audio.
Okay.
Should we try?
No. Oh, maybe. Yeah, go on. Give it a crack.
All right.
You've got a $10 note. I've got a $10 note. We've both got... I've only got 8 digits on mine, though.
Okay, so you've got 8 digits. I've got 9. No idea how that works. That
17 is a variable. On the table.
Yeah. Yep. All right. I'm going to say there is 6 fives.
6 fives. I'm going to say Liar's Poker.
Oh, no. That's kind of...
I don't have any fives.
Oh, no. I only have one.
Oh, whoa. Ballsy move from you. Anyway, so that's how it's played. So I would have taken Renner's $10 note there and we would have played on again. So
let's get back to the book.
Yes.
It starts with the head of this bond trade. Well, it's about this bond trading firm, Solomon Brothers. It starts with the head of the firm challenging one of the head traders to one game, $1 million game of Liar's Poker. And the head trader says, sure, but it's got to be $10 million. And the head of the firm backs down. And that sort of gives an insight into the testosterone-fueled trading floor that was Salomon Brothers in the 80s.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, why did they write the book?
Why did he write the book? I think, well, he sums it up in the end pretty nicely. You know, he goes on to talk about how, despite all the fact that, there was all this money to be made. So he was a graduate at the time that this book was written. And when he finished and left the company, I think he'd been there for 2 years and was one of the highest paid employees for how far he had been into the company. He made a bonus of a couple of $100,000. But he said that despite all the testosterone and the money making and the fun and the partying and all that sort of stuff, at the end of the day, it just wasn't meaningful for him and it wasn't his sort of direction in life. And I guess the whole book sort of leads up to that point and really outlines what it was, what life was like on Wall Street as a bond trader. And there's some pretty interesting and sort of exaggerated examples in there of what it was like, which I found really interesting. Why do you think he wrote the book?
Oh, I think to tell the story of Solomon Brothers is probably to tell the story of Wall Street in the 1980s. And given that he lived through it, it's he had a pretty interesting perspective. Mm. So for background, if people haven't heard of Solomon Brothers, they were a bond trading firm, an investment bank on Wall Street. And in the 1980s, they essentially invented the mortgage bond. Mortgage bonds existed before, but they weren't big until the 80s. And this one trader, Louis Rinieri, who, if you've seen The Big Short, features in the start of it, he created this mortgage bond trading unit, convinced all these banks, especially like little savings and loans banks in America, to trade. To the point where in 1984, this is from the book, in 1984, Rinieri could argue plausibly that his mortgage bond department made more money than the rest of Wall Street combined.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So they were just raking it in. And the numbers were, so in 1977, American savings and loans banks held about $12 billion in mortgage bonds. By 1986, that was up to $150 billion. So more than 10x increase in mortgage bonds being held by these banks. And that just shows the growth of the industry. And Michael Lewis had a front row seat to a lot of it.
Yeah, very interesting. So talking of Solomon Brothers, they did eventually decline and fall apart, which we'll probably get to. But one thing I found interesting where you said, it probably sums up Wall Street. Something that did differentiate them from Wall Street was, and this is from the book, Solomon Brothers was the only major firm in Wall Street in the early 80s with no system for allocating costs. As unbelievable as it seems, there was no measure taken for the bottom line and people were judged on the sum total of the revenues on their trading books, irrespective of what cost it would generate. So, or it generated to get that revenue. So I found that pretty interesting, the very loose management style that eventually ended up to being their detriment, I guess.
Yeah. It all did fall apart. So the book finishes in, 1988, 1989. Solomon is not doing as well. They had a massive purge where they just gutted a lot of their traders and they just cut a lot of their staff. What we don't read in the book is after that, in, I think, the early 90s, they got done for rigging treasury bond auctions. And there are basically rules around how much you can subscribe to the auction, because, say, if you control 90% of a treasury bond auction, then you can manipulate the price. And so treasury put rules in. Salomon were breaking those rules to have more of the auction to be able to, like, squeeze out the shorts and stuff like that. They got caught. A couple of people went to jail. The head of the bank got fired. And actually, Warren Buffett was brought in to write the ship. And that was a whole saga in his life. And then eventually Solomon sort of faded into the background and got bought out by another company, and then got bought out by Citigroup. So didn't collapse, but never got back to their high-flying mid-1980s ways.
Nah, dead as a doorknob. So Ren, yeah. I guess to summarize for me, I have 3 points that I took away from it from a learning perspective. One is, when a lot of people are after the same commodity, it largely becomes overvalued. That was straight from the book. Yep. Two, rumors move markets, so it's important to separate the noise. And three, there is no master of the markets. Do you have any learnings before I go on to my final one, which is to see if you pass the investment banking quiz?
Oh, I'm nervous about this. I guess I have one person that I found really interesting, and then one big learning. Okay. So John Merriweather is one of the key traders in this book. He's actually the person that gets challenged to the game of liar's poker at the start of the book. Yeah. The name probably isn't familiar to a lot of people, but he was a really influential sort of quant trader in the 80s and started a quant trading unit at Solomon that made a lot of their money, especially after the mortgage bond department sort of fell apart. But then, if anyone has heard of long-term capital management, John Merriweather left Solomon to go and start long-term capital management after this whole treasury auctions scandal. And then long-term capital management also almost brought down the entire financial system in the 90s. So he's a fascinating character and someone that I would suggest reading about. He's had an interesting career, to say the least. But anyway, so yeah, I found him really interesting. I would love to interview him on Equity Mates, but I think we'd have to get a little bit bigger first.
Yes.
And then my key takeaway was just, when you read this book and you visualize this trading floor, all of their incentives are so short term. Their positions are held for days, if not minutes. They are churning through their book and they have just good information flow. They have a lot of capital behind them. And when you read that and you think about how you're on the other side of some of these trades, you're not going to beat them in the short term. But because their incentives are all so short term, there's not a lot of long-term thinking in how they position themselves and how they try and, you know, buy things that will compound over a long period of time. So I think it just reinforced to me that the one advantage that we have over these massive institutions is we're not subject to the same short-term performance pressures that they are. We don't have to report quarterly. We don't even have to report annually. So we do. That is the one advantage that we have over them. And that's not going away. And I think you need to take full advantage of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was pretty grotesque in some parts, where especially when they were talking about junk bonds and forcing these bonds on customers who would pay just so they can either get it off their books, knowing full well that it's a piece of junk, and so that they can pocket a couple of million in commission. It was not great to see in some aspects. But Ren, so yes. right at the start of the book, as I said, Michael was a graduate at the time. He started in their internship program and their what seemed like a pretty intense period of training. And he was talking about the interview process to become an investment banker. And I found this very interesting, comparing it to what you have to go through now to become an investment banker. So I'll just read from the book. Although I wasn't ready to be an investment banker, I was, in a funny way, prepared for my interview. I had memorized these few facts, widely accepted by Princeton undergraduates to be part of an investment banking interview survival kit. Investment banking applications were expected to be culturally literate. For example, in 1982 at least, they had to be able to define the following terms. Ren, will you pass an investment banking?
Oh, no.
Ready? Hard work. Stock, bond, private placement, and partnership. Could you
am I actually just defining them?
Well, I mean, could you define all of those without fail? Hard work, stock, bond, private placement.
Partnership. Yeah, the only one that's maybe subjective is hard work. Like, how do you define it? But true. Yeah, I could define the others.
Yeah, so, I mean, what a stitch-up. Imagine if it was that easy these days to waltz into to Macquarie Bank or, you know, Goldman Sachs, and all you had to do was sit down and define hard work, stock, bond, private placement, and partnership. I mean, what the hell?
Yeah. Oh, I thought this was going to be a hard test. I was G-ing up for
something. I know, I scared you there a bit, but no.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. No, Bring back the 80s.
They were saying that... that like Lewis Ranieri's mortgage trading department, you know, like none of them were sort of university educated, at least at the beginning. No. They were just, you know, guys who were, you know,
hustlers,
who fell into this, and they were traders. That's what they were. They weren't, you know, trying to outsmart people. They were just trading. Yeah. And then you sort of see this move towards quants, and John Merriweather brings in a bunch of like university academics and stuff like that. And it's a different way of trading and looking at the market.
Mm.
But yeah, well, let's go tell Goldman that we can define those five terms and see if they'll offer us a job.
Get us on board. I'll even define a sixth term.
Oh, wow. Will you? Which one?
I don't know. Investing. All right, Ren. So let's wrap it up there. We now obviously are moving into November, and we've got another book. What are we reading this month, and where can our listeners get it?
So this month we are reading one of the investing classics. It is The Little Book That Still Beats the Market. It's just an updated version of Joel Greenblatt's classic, The Little Book That Beats the Market. If you haven't heard of Joel Greenblatt, his fund, Gotham Capital, returned an average of 40% over 20 years, 40% annually over 20 years, which ridiculous. Is just absurd. Like Buffett is mid-20s, obviously over a longer period of time, but still 40% over annualized over 20 years is just, it's crazy.
Phenomenal, yeah.
So this is the time to join the book club, because this is going to be a good read. It's got a great reputation. A couple of our interviews have recommended it. So jump on our website. You can see our book club page. You can buy the book. You can join the book club, and you can listen to the first episode of December, where we'll be discussing Joel Greenblatt's book.
Yeah, perfect. So I'm looking forward to the read, Ren. Liar's Poker was a great start. Hopefully this takes it up another level, and can't wait to discuss it in December. We'll talk then.
Yeah.
We'll talk before then.
Can't wait.
We'll talk books then.
Equity Mates and the people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. This is general advice only. Please speak to a financial professional to understand how they pertain to your individual situation.